What was that race?
You made it.
Oh, yeah, I made it. I'm here. By Jove, I'm here. Wait, hold on. Okay. Okay, all fingers, yes, okay. Ears, hair, still not a ginger, but yeah, I'm here.
I'm off to see the wizard.
The wonderful wizard of Odd. The wonderful wizard of Hobbs.
Hobbs.
Yes, indeed.
Hobbs.
This has been pure insanity tonight, just trying to get everything together. Whew, what a busy day.
Let me tell you.
Bad traffic.
Did you get your oil changed?
I got my oil changed, yeah. New brake pads. Everything was taken care of, yes. All is coming together according to our dark plan. Give yourself to the dark side. Your powers are weak, old man. You should not have come. Hubbo. Oh, okay.
Rousey.
Yes, indeed, Hubbo. Okay, let me see here. Oh, yeah, I got to get you some audio real quick.
I'm waiting to receive the file.
I'm going
to
send it from the Graylian account. As you can see, I'm calling you from my other account once again.
Yeah, that's the one I like anyway.
All right. Where's the USB? Hello. Thank you. Removable disk for presenting yourself. So, where did you go? My computer is misbehaving itself.
Well, I tell you, it's been a fall day here. Rainy, leaves blowing.
Yeah, right.
My gosh.
What the devil is going on here? Oh, man, please don't do anything strange.
Here comes the lovely bird with a fresh cup of Joe.
I'm going to need a cup of something here in a moment, although the caffeine's just getting to me so much lately. We may need to start about 5 after, just to be on the safe side.
You need to,
Hobbs.
Get on some sang.
Yeah, right.
Get that stomach lining leathered up a little bit.
What is going on here? Removable disc. Come on.
Sang.
May I access the room? Oh, there's something going on with this computer. I'm going to do a quick restart just to be on the safe side.
Oh my God.
No, not with that one. With this one. We're okay. Mecca Lecca High, Mecca Heiny Ho.
Rise up against me.
Man, I've got so many audio files. My desktop is a nightmare. It looks like something out of a Lovecraft story. A Lovecraftian tale of woe and suspense. Actually, that would be Poe. Poe is woe. Lovecraft is aftermath. Constantly.
Firework frenzy.
Fire! Well, I'm sorry. It's actually fire! I'll take you to burn! What are you playing back there? What is all this madness I'm hearing?
I am man of fire.
Are you watching He-Man again, Hubbo?
Huh?
Are you watching He-Man again, Hubbo?
Flash Gordon.
I know what you're watching.
Mm-mm.
There goes the rest of my... Okay, audio file's on its way to you there, Hubbo.
I'm playing a slot machine.
Oh, God. Well, turn that down. We've got work to do, Hubbs. Tom Danhauser called me at around lunchtime today, which must have been morning Pacific time.
Do you want a party?
We're going to be partying here next summer when we do the Coast to Coast Live thing that they're going to be doing. And old Smokey Waddell and I are going to be doing some music while George sings. But there's also going to be an interview segment where I'm going to be talking about UFOs and stuff. Bill Forstchen's going to be there. It's going to be really cool. I love Bill Forstchen. I never, ever get to see the guy.
Imagine if your every dream came true, your every wish and desire fulfilled.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, I need to get last minute round down. What is up with all the ads on Skype now?
Bring your best friends together for a coffee date. Try a free group video call now. Courtesy of the fine folks at Skype.
Fine folks.
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 That's a great word. Folks. Hi, folks.
Folks.
Yeah, you do it even better. Hi, folks. Folks.
Terminator.
Folks.
Folks.
I went in to see my mom this afternoon because I had to visit my parents while my car was in the shop, and I walked in the door and I said to my mom, every drop of blood you spill puts more flesh on my bones. She thought it was so funny.
You said that?
Yeah.
Every drop of blood you spill puts more flesh on my bones.
Yeah. We got a couple of other goodies that my mom and I have been enjoying recently. There's at the end of The Wicker Man, where Sergeant Neil Howie is carried up to the cliff and he sees the Wicker Man for the first time and he goes,
oh God! Oh Jesus Christ!
He's just flipping out. That's a pretty good one. And then also in Vincent Price, Madhouse, at the beginning, he goes over to touch the woman on the back of the shoulder, and her head rolls off. It's already been severed, and she's just sitting there dead, and he leans back and goes, ah! It's the most absurd scream. Oh, God, it is so funny. I wish I had, like, they're so soundbite worthy. I need to make soundbites of both of them. But in Madhouse, Vincent Price does it twice. Later in the film, he does it again. Ah! And the way he leans back, you see every tooth in his mouth. It's so hilarious. Those old horror movies are so damn funny.
Don't send me that file.
Oh, it's there. It won't. Is it not coming through?
Oh, is it?
Oh, it's on the Graylian. I just sent it to you from my Graylian account.
It ain't there.
Is it not? What direction would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could huck food? It made no sense. That was the stupidest thing I think I've ever heard come out of my own mouth. There was that one time I endorsed the Roswell slides, but oh, that's right, that never happened.
We've got 15 seconds.
I always sound so excited, like, or no, surprised when you tell me we've only got... How much time? Okay. Let me say, like, alley-oop!
Seconds. 10 seconds up in this B.
Up in this B.
Are you ready?
Yes. Oh, I was born ready.
Okay. In 3, 2, 1, we're live.
Alon Z.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker. Live and loving it, I'm Micah Hanks. And you've locked in, it is the one and only world-renowned Graylian Report. Broadcasting to you worldwide around the globe via the KGRA. Global Radio Alliance. Glad to be here, as always, kicking off Monday night with a bang or a boom, whichever you may prefer. Mystery booms, perhaps. What a busy day. What one hell of a weekend, in fact. As we'll be discussing here in mere moments. Tonight, we've got a special program lined up. We are going to be talking about what has occurred over the weekend in Europe. We're going to be talking also about other items trending in the news. A brief repast with some input from those of you out there. And then finally, we've got a couple of gentlemen who will be joining us during Hour 2. Author Joshua Cutchin, and also blogger and esotericist, Red Pill Junkie. In the second hour, we're going to be talking about the war on consciousness. Cannot wait to have those guys on the show. Something that I should probably do more often. But we'll get to all of that a little later. So here we are in the Graylian Bunker. Busy day. Busy weekend, in fact. And I feel like I've been world traveling all day. Back just in time to kick things off here. Well, in time? Almost in time, I guess, to kick things off on target for the weekly Graylian Report. Back in Master Control, Fort Smith, Arkansas. The man with the plan and the guy with the big barely voice, Mr. Race Hobbs. Are you on the Hobbo line? He probably is. We'll come back to him later. I know he's out there somewhere in time. Those of you who download the podcast, by the way, will probably have already figured out exactly why he's not there right now, but we'll get him back in a little later. Oh, so as I mentioned, what a weekend. Friday the 13th kicked off in rare form for me because as I venture out from the Graylian bunker, the first time that day, I behold a range fire on a mountain, which Graylian X subscribers already know about. And there's literally a mountain on fire across the street. And so I get down into town. You know, I head down Gray Street and I go down to the store. I'm actually purchasing a money order. And everybody's talking about this mountain that's on fire. Yeah, Friday the 13th. I mean, really, this is really kind of starting to feel like Friday the 13th here. Anyway, with all that said, later that night, I'm in town. I go to a restaurant, and that's when the news breaks. And that's what everybody probably knows about right now. Friday evening in Paris, it was a series of coordinated terrorist attacks that occurred in Paris, France, and also one of the northern suburbs of Paris. The attacks ranged from mass shootings to suicide bombings, and of course also it culminated at the end of the evening with a hostage situation at a music venue. We have audio.
On a mild November night, this is how 3 hours of carnage began to unfold. A masked gunman opened fire with an automatic weapon, shooting through windows at a cafe and restaurant in the same street.
I heard some noise when I was at the bistro, which is where I work. I got out, I started running. I was looking for where the sound was coming from. I figured out it was coming from Le Carillon and Le Petit Cambodge. I arrived at the scene and there were lots of dead bodies on the ground. Lots of dead bodies. Lots of dead bodies.
By now, the number of dead had already reached double figures. There were reports of other shootings. But if there was any doubt, Paris was under siege. The sound of a massive explosion unleashed to a global TV audience watching France play Germany left nobody in any doubt.
Now that audio, I want to point out that you're hearing when people are cheering with the sound of the explosion outside the stadium, you've got to keep in mind that it is customary that fireworks are launched often at these friendlies, at these matches. And this was a Germany and France match that was taking place there at the Stade de France. And when they heard this, no doubt, at first they thought they were probably hearing fireworks. Those who were in attendance at the game initially were not even told, for fear of panic, that Paris was under attack at that very moment.
A second blast threw the crowd into panic. And France's President François Hollande, who'd been at the game, to be driven away to a secure location.
And even though we were getting news reports, we thought it was something trivial. We thought it was a hoax or something that had gone wrong. We didn't realise the full extent of it until we got outside.
Spectators flooded onto the open space of the pitch. Amidst the spectre of an increasingly terrifying night, seemingly the only safe place they were prepared to go.
The survivors of the ordeal, of course, were telling their own accounts of making it through the evening in various parts of Paris that were affected.
The concert had started about half an hour before. We heard firecracker noises and we turned around and saw two young people. Two young people. Well, we were a bit far away, so two people with machine guns firing into the crowd. So we all laid on the ground. There was panic, screams, shots continued to be fired. One managed to open the door leading to the rooftop, so we all got up there. We waited for a while, and there was a man whose apartment has a window that opens into the rooftop. He opened the window and let us into his apartment. We stayed the whole time at his place, in the dark, waiting for events to unfold.
Now, of course, what they're describing right there is what happened later in the evening, where the band known as the Eagles of Death Metal had been performing. The attacks had begun earlier that night at around 9:20 p.m. local time. There were three separate suicide bombings outside the Stade de France. Later at the Bataclan Theater is where attackers took the hostages engaged in a standoff with police, which lasted for several hours. And then one of the survivors, Jenny Watkins, had described these attacks in particular detail, and over the weekend she had uploaded videos and also had appeared on television discussing what had happened. She had been in attendance there while the band was playing when the attack occurred.
We were in the middle of the concert, and all of a sudden, this huge shootout started, and it was a quite a high-pitched shootout. Myself, never being in a shootout in my life, I actually thought it was a joke. I thought the band was, like, playing a joke on us, and I didn't believe it at first. But then I saw people screaming, and I was on the first floor of the venue. I wasn't down on, you know, at the bottom. So I heard all the shots, and they were consistent. There were a lot of shots, and they didn't stop. And that's when I realized maybe we have to leave. And with my friend, I took her hand, and we hid behind the seats, and we managed to, slip away through the safety exit that was near to where we were. There was a panic, but we managed to escape in the street. But there were people harmed, people were wounded, there was blood, and people had, bullet wounds in their legs. It wasn't nice. It was obvious that we were on the first floor in the balcony, which we called the balcon in French, and it was obvious they were underneath, and we didn't take it seriously. But then all of a sudden, everybody started panicking, and that's when we realized that it was serious, and that those shooters were actually, coming up to the first floor as well. And I don't know how, the universe was in my favor. I don't know, but I managed to escape through a safety exit with a lot of other people without being harmed. And, I crossed paths with people who were wounded. I saw a girl who had a bullet wound in her thigh. Somebody else was on the floor with blood everywhere. It was horrible.
Now, obviously, the terror group ISIL has claimed responsibility for all these attacks, as is well known right now. 129 victims were killed, 89 of which had died at the Bataclan Theater alone. There were 415 others who were admitted for care at area hospitals with injuries sustained during those attacks. This included 80 people described as being seriously injured. And in addition to the victims, 7 attackers died as well. And as of today, Monday, authorities continue with a massive search for accomplices believed to still remain at large. Now, the attacks were the deadliest that have occurred in France since the end of the Second World War. And this has, in fact, been called the deadliest in Europe since the Madrid train bombings that occurred back in 2004. And meanwhile, again, the Washington Post reports today that a video was released by an Islamic State subgroup, and this appears to show militants in Iraq praising not only the Paris shootings, but also warning you've got a similar attack coming that could take place in Washington. Always lovely to hear. The message, which was distributed by the Islamic State-related social network accounts on Monday, claimed to be made by an individual called Wilayat Kirkuk, a group that is based in a province north of Iraq. Now, its authenticity could not be immediately confirmed, but while the video does closely resemble others released by the Islamic State, it lacked the theatrics and high quality for which many of these are known. But think for a moment about the way that social media has played such an integral role in the reach that ISIL has. Terrorism in the modern era is not just what we saw in Paris, not just the fact that this is so calculated, so planned. They're all wearing black. Every car that was used for the escapes was apparently black in color. 100 rounds spent at least at every location where shootings occurred. And despite the ineffectiveness on the whole of the suicide bombings, some have speculated that the suicide bombings outside of the Stade de France may have merely been intended to distract away from the carnage that would unfold later at the Bataclan that evening, which would carry on well into the early hours of the following day. And with all this emphasis that we're seeing on the technological component here, this morning it was also announced that the hacker group Anonymous have declared outright war against ISIL following the attacks that occurred Friday night. They posted a video on YouTube in French, which said it would use its knowledge to unite humanity and warned that terrorists should expect us being Anonymous. Behind their signature mask, there was a spokesperson speaking in the video. Anonymous from all over the world will hunt you down. You should know that we will find you and we will not let you go. We will launch the biggest operation ever against you. Now, in the past, I've expressed very mixed feelings about Anonymous. And I think that we have to be very careful when we have people who are capable of such harm. I guess the old maxim as told to the young Peter Parker by his uncle. With great power comes great responsibility, does come to mind, and with the reach of the World Wide Web, we have a lot of responsibility, especially when it is placed in the hands of those who can manipulate it in such potentially devastating ways. But in this instance, I'm all for it, and I hope that Anonymous will raise almighty hell with ISIL. And I'm not the only one who holds this position. Evan Schumann at Computer World had blogged about this today. He said, along with the news that the French had launched airstrikes against ISIL positions, came the word that the cyber revenge group calling itself Anonymous has declared war on ISIS. I never thought I would say this, Schumann writes, but Anonymous might be our savior. Attacking ISIS military is necessary, but the group has always exerted its influence through social media, using it for both fundraising and recruitment. Both activities are essential to ISIS's continuing existence and effectiveness. The weaponry it uses in its terror campaign is expensive, and when every successful operation ends in death or the arrest of all participants, recruitment is critical, which makes Anonymous's involvement intriguing. ISIS, you should be very scared, Schumann writes. Anonymous's official Twitter area for Operation Paris has already reported that more than 3,824 Twitter accounts that are pro-ISIS are now down, a number that has been steadily climbing. That's on top of tens of thousands of pro-ISIS Twitter accounts that Anonymous took down before the Paris attacks, along with a large number of donation pages for the group. Housed on the dark web, which Anonymous closed, according to a report that appeared in The Atlantic. Now, Anonymous's key message on Twitter is to make no mistake. Anonymous is at war with Daesh. We won't stop opposing the Islamic State. We're also better hackers. I love that. The last sentence, of course, is key. What Anonymous is talking about is a cyber war against ISIS. And what we are seeing, ladies and gentlemen, you the listeners, in the modern era is a kind of war being waged against terror by a group of civilians worldwide that is taking place within the cloud, within the intangible web that is the World Wide Web, the Internet. I have to say, as fascinating as it is, I wish Anonymous well in their efforts, because this is something that has to stop. This is something that has to end right now. And Schumann goes on to write that, to Anonymous's credit, they're indeed better hackers. Let's hope that they are. He also wrote, this could be very effective. While governments bomb and soldiers attack on the ground, it's essential that ISIS's recruitment and funding be killed. If DDoS and other shutdown tactics make social media useless to a terror group, it will find it far more difficult to fund terror and recruit replacements. Now, one more thing I want to address as it relates to the discussion about what happened on Friday here, before we go to break, is the fact that over the weekend there are already a number of odd theories that are coming about. Some of it's warranted. Some of it is warranted. And with regard to concern over the way people would speculate about this, Mr. McNonymous of Middle Theory fame contacted me on Friday while this was unfolding, and he actually said, you know, we need to do a show. I said, well, do you want to come on the Grayling Report? He said, no, not that kind of show. We need to do a show. There will be an episode of Middle Theory in which Mr. McNonymous, joined by yours truly, we give a breakdown about what has happened. We look at some of the elements that have not been reported. Mr. McNonymous found something I haven't heard anybody else talk about that involves a bomb threat that had been placed earlier that day that I'm surprised nobody else is talking about. And I think, given the circumstances and the importance, the gravity of this circumstance, that will probably be placed on the Middle Theory feed as well as the Grayling Report feed, so look for it in either location. But there is, it's already recorded, it's in the can, it will be going live. We have an episode of Middle Theory. Unbelievable how this comes about. But in an instance like this, it's not about grandstanding and taking advantage of horror that is being enacted against innocent lives anywhere in the world. I think that as individuals of the community we call Earth, Team Good Guys, Team Humanity, we have to do our part. In the Grayling Daily News, you'll find also that throughout the week, we'll be linking where you can actually pledge support, whether that be donations, whatever else, what you can do to help the people, the survivors, and those who are having to live with the aftermath of this terror attack. And we'll not only link that, but also we will continue to produce information through the podcasting that we have available. I hope that the KGRA will do just as well in an effort to present solidarity and address the fact that we will not stand for anything like this. The magnitude which we have seen in terms of the attack that occurred on Friday in Paris, this is on par with 9/11 here in the United States. This is the worst terror attack that has been sustained in that country since World War II, as we stated earlier. We as the citizens of Earth, and I'm not talking one world government, I'm talking we as team humanity here, people, will not stand for this. And so we will do everything that we can, including a Middle Theory podcast that's coming out this week to educate people. Because we're already seeing hoaxes and conspiracy theories that are showing up online where people are speculating ridiculous BS about this. Let's look at a few of them. Here are the top five right now. Okay, so number one, there was a photograph of one of the purported terrorists actually taking a selfie before the attacks. Viral photo, the Twitter link shows, of Sikh selfie doctored to look like Paris ISIS terrorist. This is the whole point. It was doctored. What they did was they doctored in the vest with the guy taking the picture with his tablet. Totally bogus. Don't believe it. Totally bogus. Again, here, this, there's the crisis actor thing. And I know a lot of people in the listening audience of this very program probably feel that there is some legitimacy to the crisis actor instance. Now, I don't want to cite Newtown. I don't want to talk about other instances. Let's talk about Paris. People are trying to say one of the victims leaving the Bataclan that evening resembled a woman who showed up in two separate events that occurred stateside. That's absolutely not true. Bustle.com actually reports this hoax has made the rounds before, and now it's being reappropriated for the Paris attacks. The allegation is that the same woman has been seen grieving at multiple tragedies. The implication is that she's actually a crisis actor, and that the events she supposedly spotted, Sandy Hook, Boston Marathon, etc., 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 are actually false flags. Well, this is nonsense. I want you people to please understand. They're not the same person. Although, when a person's face is contorted while they're crying, where they're dealing with the grief and the shock of being shot at and seeing their friends die, a lot of people are going to look like that. It's very simple to take a person with a similar haircut who is in that grieving state of shock and take some grainy photograph that's been placed online and say, oh, look, same actress. No, sorry, it's not. Another is the fact that there is a theory that the Battlefield 3 video game actually features a chapter wherein the player has to stop a terrorist attack in Paris, which predicted that this event would take place. There's also another theory right now that just following the attack in Paris, it was just within a few hours that there was a report about a camp of migrants in a French town called Calais, or Calais, I guess, that had caught on fire, destroying many tents and housing structures. Many Syrians had lived in that camp, and soon after the fire, speculation surfaced that it was an intentional act of arson carried out as a misplaced act of revenge for the Paris attacks. Well, it is true that a refugee camp had caught fire at that location. However, there's no evidence so far that this was done intentionally, let alone as a retaliation for the attacks in Paris. And, of course, there's a continued effort to tie Donald Trump into all this. There was a Blaze News article that had talked about Trump asking why we can't just say Islamist extremists. And maybe he's right to say, should we say that? Because this is indeed what these people are. But I'm sad to see that in the United States, you know, the up-and-coming would-be politicians for the next round here in the U.S. political system are using this at every avenue, at every opportunity to try and politicize and to try and make political points. And I would just ask this, can we not just allow people to grieve? Let's at least allow a week of grieving. We can offer insight, we can offer analysis, but please, those of you at home listening, I would ask you, please don't forget and hold dear to your heart the fact that this is still unfolding. We don't have all the information. There are people out there who are conspiracy mongering. There are people out there who are actually calling for idiocy in the absence of facts. We need further information. We'll do what we can to bring that to you on programs like this one. And when we come back, we'll get to a few listener emails as well as other headlines in the news here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Caught in the midst of a head spin as we are still trying to make sense of what's happened over the weekend in France, our hearts, our prayers, and certainly our pledge of support goes out to those people, those poor people who had to suffer at the hands of, you know, I don't think I have the words right now for the loathe I feel for anyone who would think that the right way to carry out any kind of change in the world is to claim the lives of innocent people. I should stop right there because it just makes me so angry. And it's difficult for someone. I was called by someone. Some crazy individual on Facebook today began coming after me and saying, well, you're the news guy. Why don't you give us some information about who McNonymous is? Who is this Chris McCullum character? I hate that from time to time I have to actually block people. I try to be, I don't even consider myself anything more than a guy who dabbles with audio and who writes from time to time when time allows. And I like to travel. That's a good description of Micah Hanks for you. And yet, if you have a hobby where in the comfort of your own home you kick back and you blog, or you buy a couple of I've got more than a couple of microphones. I've got a lot of stuff. We've got a lot of equipment in the Graylian studio. But the point is that, you know, again, I'm a completely autonomous, unfunded, independent operation right here. And people, oh, you're the news guy. I just want to say, shut the hell up, please. There are people across the Atlantic Ocean who are dying. You know, I've got friends in Europe. I've got friends in Europe who are sending me messages to my cell phone this morning on their way to work saying, I'm scared. I'm scared to be on a train right now. I'm terrified of what's happening in the world. What can you do? You can't run. Formidable though the TARDIS is, I can't be in everybody's backyard and I can't prepare a lunch for them, you know, and tell them everything's going to be fine. I can look into the future. You're okay and everybody else will be too. I can't do that. Nobody can, you know. But this is what we all struggle with as human beings, again, playing on the side of team humanity here. When something like this happens, nobody can see what's going to happen. People can point the finger at intelligence agencies within government, the all-seeing eye, you know, of all these surveillance programs and intelligence agencies around the world. Oh, they can watch us and they can look at you taking a bath, or they can watch you, you know, feeding your kids, you know, snacks when they get home from school through webcams, but they can't predict that something like this is happening. We have to separate the myth from the fact. Yes, surveillance is broad-reaching in a global sense. Yes, most of it emanates from the United States. Yes, there will be further-reaching implications politically and also in relation to what I'm discussing right here, right now, as a result of what we saw in Paris this weekend. Yes, the surveillance state plays into this. Yes, some conspiracy-oriented thinking is warranted. And even I will tell you that. But right now, again, put the vitriol aside. Stop attacking each other. That is what they want. They want for people like you and I to attack each other. They want to disenfranchise the Islamic community. They want everyone to think that everyone who is Islamic, of course, is radical. And then there'll be the calling for the closing of borders and all this sort of stuff. Of course, it doesn't matter that one of the suicide bombers, of course, had been a French national who had lived in Paris for years. Yeah, closing the borders really would have helped with that. We get really close at this point to getting political with this, and I don't want to do that, and so I'm going to move on this program. But when something of this magnitude happens, I realize there are some people who listen to a podcast like this because it does present a repast, an escape from what we hear about in the news. And yes, it is depressing. Yes, it is troubling. But how good are we? How good are you? I will speak to the listener at this point. How good can we be as a civilization if we do not take seriously, and despite the trouble it presents, truly commit ourselves to contemplative thought and rumination, heartfelt consideration for what is happening right now? This is significant, and if it is significant, it will be talked about on this program. If you don't like that, unsubscribe, flip the channel, change the station. I do care. I can't make you keep listening. But I hope that those of you out there who understand the importance of what has happened in the world right now will stay with us. We have to stay together. And as long as you're listening to a program like this, part of that will mean hearing about that on a program like this. That is just the reality that we face right now. And we have to, I think, together as humans, for God's sake. So with that, we have other news that I'd like to touch on here. This is some big news. I am always fascinated with new developments as it relates to the ancient lineage of humankind. And Time reports that in a paper that was published today in the journal Nature Communications, researchers used DNA sequencing to identify a new lineage of European ancestry, which is actually beyond the three groups that have previously been known. These, of course, being indigenous hunters, Middle Eastern farmers, and herders that were known as the Yamnaya. Now, the new fourth group they're calling, the Caucasus hunter-gatherers, fills a previously missing link. Let me be very careful in using that term, by the way. This is a missing link. Actually, I don't even like that term. We would call this a new component in the genetic origins of the Yamnaya, which had not been fully understood previously. Researchers concluded that these Caucasus hunter-gatherers were a separate population after testing DNA samples from two different sets of remains discovered in western Georgia. One that was nearly 10,000 years old, and one that was more than 13,000 years old. Now, apparently one of the senior authors of the study, Andrea Monica, had said that the question of where the Yamnaya come from has been something of a mystery up until now. That's what this actually has helped us to understand. Monica actually is with the University of Cambridge's Department of Zoology, and she said further that we can now answer that as we've found that their genetic makeup is a mix of Eastern European hunter-gatherers and a population from this pocket of Caucasus hunter-gatherers who weathered much of the last ice age in apparent isolation. This Caucasus pocket is the fourth major strand of ancient European ancestry, one that we were unaware of completely until now. We think we know so much about the past. We think we know so much about the present. We think we can predict what we'll know about the future, and yet discoveries like this continue to be forthcoming that literally are of such importance that they help us to reshape what we thought we knew about ancient humans. And of course, everything leading up to what we are right now. But as far as looking ahead to the future, as far as looking ahead and saying, well, where are we headed? You know, there was a story that was carried back, I think, on Thursday or Friday that appeared in the Telegraph that was talking about the first genetically modified humans. And it was saying that the first genetically modified humans might already exist within the next 2 years. Within the next 2 years. I mean, that is a blink in the grand cosmological, chronological scheme. The Telegraph reports humans who have had their DNA genetically modified could exist within 2 years after a private biotech company announced plans to start the first trials into a groundbreaking new technique. Aditas Medicine, which is based in the United States here, said it plans to become the first lab in the world to genetically edit the DNA of patients suffering from a genetic condition. In this case, the blinding disorder, Leber congenital amaurosis. Now, the disorder prevents normal function of the retina, the light-sensitive layer of cells at the back of the eye. It appears at birth or in the first months of life, and eventually sufferers can go completely blind. Hereditary eye disease is an obvious place to start, given that there's already precedent in classical gene therapy. The rare inherited disease is caused by defects in a gene which instructs the creation of a protein that is essential to vision. It feels fast, say the scientists involved in the study, but we are going at the pace that science allows. This told to the M-Tech conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Boy, and yet still moving more quickly than a lot of people, I think, are probably comfortable with. Speaking of moving quickly, boy, this hour is catching up on us really quickly. A couple of listener emails. Tyler writes, I recently found your website during a search for information on time slips and paranormal activities. I found the Apparitions of the Future article on your website. It was very compelling and oddly enough aligned with the conversation I'd had recently with a group of colleagues. I was wondering if you ever did any follow-up work with your thesis presented here. I'm interested in if you ever postulated an alternative theory for reports, claims of individuals interacting with future events or beings. It looks as though your book, The Ghost Rockets, may touch on that subject, but any guidance would be greatly appreciated. Thanks in advance, Tyler. I think as far as calling it a thesis, I don't know that we could call it a thesis, but some people do report what seem to be temporal disturbances. They'll be in one location, familiar to them, and all of a sudden, for an intermittent period, their surroundings are greatly changed for whatever circumstances may allow that. Whether this is something that is merely a perceptual error, you know, or some sort of an actual, you know, physical change in the environment, who knows what exactly is happening? I've talked about it. There seems to be some precedent for it, but only anecdotally. And I don't know that I've expounded on that really beyond the idea of what the general literature holds, that some people report changes, sudden changes, transitional kind of, or rather transitory, I guess, changes in an environment that seem to be indicative of something that some have called time slips. I don't know if it's really indicative of that. Who knows? There are any number of things that might contribute to a perceptual change in one's environment, including hallucinations of various different kinds, which I hope to get into in the next hour when we bring Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie into the discussion. Maybe we'll have a little time to get some of that. Adam Olson, good pal of the program, writes, regarding Unknown Henson, who you featured in a Graylian X podcast a while back, I'd never heard of the guy. He was hilarious. I wasn't sure if he was serious or not, and wow, his nerve and consistent character is impressive. I was talking about that interview with some friends of mine at a usual bar in the village, and somebody brought up Marvin Pontiac, a creation of fellow New Yorker John Leary, not as elaborate as Unknown Henson, and that jumped to the Firesign Theater. If you have never heard of them, I think you would dig it, especially their online video, Everything You Know Is Wrong. It reminds me a little of Long John Neville, which my girlfriend's father had the privilege of listening to over the airwaves back in the day. Yeah, wow. Unknown Henson, hilarious. A fellow who Graylian X subscribers know I interviewed a number of years ago, and for the Halloween edition of Graylian X, we actually featured an interview with the king of country western troubadours, as he is known. Do check that out if you're a subscriber. If you're not, and you don't know anything about what we're talking about, you're missing out. You should certainly check that out. David writes, Micah, I love the Graylian Report, especially the pre-show antics. Well, so do I. He said, just wanted to share with you an image I created of the Chicxulub crater. As I recall you mentioning this particular impact area in one of your shows. That is absolutely correct, David. He said, as you know, this was found by oil exploration in the 1960s using differences in gravity. The crater is not visible from the surface of the Earth, but is visible from space if you know what to look for. The image is filtered false-colored data from shuttle radar topography missions, which record the elevation. Thank you so much for that, David, in Australia. And hopefully maybe we can get that image linked up on the website at some point, because I'd love to be able to share that kind of stuff. The wonderful contributions that come from those in the listening audience. I get so many emails, and I want to say, if you're someone who has sent me especially a lengthy email, I, when time allows, try to respond to those personally. The quicker ones I can usually get to on the airwaves. If I have not gotten to one of your emails, please don't take offense. We get so many here at the Graylian Report. As much as I like to be able to respond to people, I just can't get to all of them in the timely manner in which I wish I could. But I do try. So hold out hope. Even weeks after the fact, sometimes late, better than never, I try to get to people. If you'd like to email me just as well, info@graylianreport.com is the way to do it. We'll pick up with more in news when we return here right after this. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks. I thought we needed something epic right there because, well, obviously I'm blaming the Daleks for everything that's going on tonight. So Master Control alerts me to the fact that we had gone off the air. Is that correct, Race?
We did. Yeah, in fact, we did. We had one of your awesome listeners call and make me aware of it because I actually wasn't even aware of it myself. I had taken my headphones off and was processing a call here in the studio. So, yeah. Yeah, we went dead.
Wait a minute. And hold on. Somebody.
Whoever that was that called, thank you for calling and helping me do my job.
Wow, people actually call. You know, we could do that here, couldn't we?
Of course.
Yeah, we could. 398-48... No, hold on. Let me try again. 828-398-4886 would be the number if you ever wanted to call into the live Graylian Report program. We haven't done that in a while. But yes,
it has been a while.
There is a live call-in number. 828-398-4886 would be the way to reach us, I think. Gosh, it's been so long. I mean, I got to really dust that off. I may have just misread what I...
Had to dust off the old bunker connection, did you?
Yes, indeed. I've actually got so many incoming call lines in the studio. We just generally don't use them because I see that the face of talk radio is changing. I mean, God help us. Tom Danheiser told me recently that Coast to Coast, he's the producer of Coast to Coast AM, but we were on the telephone earlier today, and he told me that they are starting to experiment with Skype.
Well, welcome to the new millennium.
Yeah, right? I mean... Yeah, Coast to Coast traditionally, folks, has never, ever used Skype because of the unreliability of the web. But now, you know, Skype is modifying and improving and changing and offering new services that are fit for live broadcast. And so they're starting to experiment with that because, in truth, you know, when I went on Ground Zero with Clyde Lewis a while back, we did Skype and it sounded like I was live in the studio with him. People actually were calling me afterward, very surprised that I was on the show, and they were like, wow, dude, did you go to, like, Portland? They thought I'd been in there with him, and I said, no, it's just Skype. But even the big-time talk radio programs are starting to do this. And this is what's really interesting, is with everything that happened in Paris over the weekend, I had seen interviews on the major networks with, you know, of course, following this as it developed over the weekend. And there had been interviews throughout the weekend with survivors that were conducted using Skype from their smartphones. I mean, people holding the phone up in front of their face and talking. I mean, it's incredible the reach of technology. But again, this just comes back to what we had talked about in that first segment, that with the reach and with the ability to do so much with handheld technologies, you know, it's really changing what has happened, I think, in terms of the reach also of the terror groups like ISIL who have carried out these attacks. Which is one more reason that I guess at this point it's getting really interesting because we're seeing Anonymous becoming involved. Yeah. I guess the next thing we should watch for, Race and everybody else, is the biblical prophecies and biblical prophecy-esque type phenomena that seems to be a harbinger of those strange times of the ancient Chinese curse, which I just aforementioned or at least paraphrased. Oh, hell, wait, too late. Here we go. Yeah, get this. Apparently, it seems that last year, residents of a Spanish village in Zamora were startled when what looked like raindrops of blood fell from the sky. Great! It's literally raining blood. Are we living in a Slayer song now? Oh, God. So, Discovery News reports that as this red fluid filled outdoor basins, some people reportedly feared that it was some sort of hazardous chemical that had been dropped from airplanes. Others remembered the Old Testament plagues. See? Afflicted upon Egypt. Now, as news of the strange event got around, a man from a nearby town came to see the blood-colored water for himself, even gathered a sample of it. Good thinking. For fear that he, of course, would be turned into a pillar of salt in doing so. Over the fall and the winter, he kept the blood-colored water and observed it. He noticed that the small particles in the water were staining the containers themselves, turning everything that they touched red. So finally, he sent some of the water to scientists at the University of Salamanca. When the scientists analyzed the water under a microscope, they quickly deduced what was causing the red liquid. They said that in a newly published study in Spanish Royal Society of Natural History Journal, they revealed that the culprit was what is known as Haematococcus pluliais, okay, a freshwater green microalgae that is capable of synthesizing a red carotene pigment. But that only solved part of the mystery, apparently. See, this Haematococcus pluliais isn't actually found in the Mediterranean region. So scientists said we can identify with certainty exactly what this is, what kind of algae this is. We're not talking about literal blood rains here. However, this isn't something that is indigenous to the region, so still we have the question, where does it come from? So scientists aren't exactly sure exactly what caused this red rain, we might call it, over Zamora. Meteorological data analyzed by the scientists suggests, however, that it could have been blown across the ocean by westerly winds and possibly from as far away as North America. But, you know, it's interesting because what this presents for us is a cap on a pre-existing Fortean mystery. That is, of course, the belief that it, from time to time, rains literal blood. And if you've never heard the story by Slayer, look that one up. I think I've got just enough time for one more story here. This one, EurekaAlert.org, published, has to do with the fact that researchers from the University of Rochester, and I've got to say, I'm really excited about this. Researchers from the University of Rochester say that they have found the same formula in a quantum mechanical calculation of the energy levels of a hydrogen atom as that of a mathematical formula that John Wallace first published in a book in which he derived this formula for pi as the product of an infinite series of ratios, and that was back in 1655. Now, Carl Hagen, a particle physicist at the University of Rochester, says we weren't looking for the Wallace formula for pi. It just fell into our laps. He tapped an assistant, Tamar Friedman, and they began to observe this apparent spooky trend that emerged and realized it was, in fact, a manifestation of the Wallace formula for pi. He said the special thing is that it brings out a beautiful connection between physics and math. I find it fascinating that a purely mathematical formula, and one no less from the 17th century, characterizes a physical system that was discovered, and of course that discovery took place 300 years later. The continuation of science, and of course the bridging between mathematics and the physical universe on the quantum level, perhaps. I don't think that all things in reality can be perfectly mirrored by mathematics, but it is that continuum that seems to exist, of course, that we hope to be able to use to express universally, even without language at times, through mathematics. We'll pick up with the discussion of the War of Consciousness here on the Grilling Report when we come back right after this. Welcome back to the program here as we enter the second hour tonight. In mere moments, I'll be joined by two regulars on the program. Well, they're regular enough. They haven't been on too recently, which is why we've got them back tonight. Joshua Cutchin and the enigmatic Red Pill Junkie. We'll be having a discussion that's going to deal with everything from philosophy to science to simulations and whether or not we're existing within one in our universe. Might even try and toss a little Stanley Kubrick talk into the mix. A lot of interesting stuff to touch on. Before we get into that discussion, I do want to remind you, if you like what you hear and you'd like to show a little more support for the Grailian Report and get a little additional content on a weekly basis, it's easy to do. All you got to do is sign up for Grailian X by visiting grailianreport.com/X. You can become a subscriber and get the weekly additional edition, as we call it, as well as monthly editions such as Grailian Enigmas. There'll be some special holiday-themed content coming up in the next few weeks just as well, as we're winding down 2015. Unbelievable how quickly it has gone by. And speaking of time going by, here we are as we're settling into this second hour. I'd like to bring on the two gentlemen who will be accompanying me, my companions through this little portion of the journey through time and space. The gentlemen who are joining me, I believe, actually from one state away, and then also another fellow from a country a little further south, Mr. Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie. How are you guys?
Doing great. Good evening.
Buenas tardes.
It's always... Did you say buenos tardes?
Buenas.
Yes. So the first thing I want to jump into, and actually the guys and I were catching up a little bit during the break, and Josh, I think you mentioned a while back, it was a few weeks ago, but I'd been mentioned on a episode of Mysterious Universe in relation to that whole Hopkinsville Kelly Goblins thing that Greg Newkirk had been involved with a few years ago. Is that correct? I was actually brought up on an episode. I regret to mention, by the way, I haven't actually heard it, so you may have to fill me in a little on this.
you did, and Red, feel free to jump in and correct me if I get anything wrong. But as yeah. As I recall, it was on the extended portion of the episode for members. And basically, where you entered into the picture is, according to this particular blog entry, you at one point helped Greg track down the location of a secret underground alien base that, according to this article, you actually leaned in and told him a psychic told you. You whispered it to him very very somberly. And you took him up to the mountains, I think. Was it around Black Mountain, Red? I think it was.
It would have been Brown Mountain, probably. Brown Mountain, North Carolina.
Yeah, probably Brown Mountain. Okay, yeah, Brown but Mountain. The thing that made it so enigmatical, you know, is how you said it, you know, very enigmatically, that, you know, a psychic had confirmed the location of this secret alien underground base.
And then proceeded to take them to the actual base and point out where the entrance was that you were familiar with. So
the entrance. Oh, I love it. I love it. It's all true.
Well, that does it. Okay, next topic.
Yeah.
Next topic.
No, I want to see why I like having these guys on. It's nice just to have a good conversation with people from time to time. there's certainly some truth to that. It's absolutely true, by the way, that Greg contacted me. I should tell my version of the story, although, again, having not heard what aired on Mysterious Universe, apart from you guys retelling it here, you know, I don't know which parts, you know, I may remember a little differently or whatnot, but of course there's no animosity about that. I'm sure it's all in good in good fun. What had happened was around 2012, it was right after the first Paradigm Symposium, and I'd just gotten back in Asheville, North Carolina, and Greg had told me prior to all that that he and Dana and a couple of their friends, they were working on a documentary film at that time, and Greg had, you know, he and I had corresponded quite a bit, but he had said, you know, I'm going to be in the area, it would be great, first and foremost, just to catch up, but would you have any interest in taking us up to the Brown Mountain, Linville Gorge area? Because we'd like to, you know, do a segment about that and about some of the lore associated with it, which includes the following. That, yes, years ago, there was a member of MUFON who had contacted me under rather odd circumstances, and he had told me that he believed that there was evidence of a underground base of some kind below Brown Mountain, but he wasn't the only person who had believed that. In fact, there's been a long-held rumor about that, so we'll come back around to that in a moment. Obviously, you know, leaping at the opportunity just to get to be able to, you know, catch up with Greg and Dana and everybody and hang out with them a little bit, I told him, yeah, here's where we can meet, and let's definitely do that. And so I joined them, and I did take them up onto Table Rock, is what it was, actually, which is adjacent, several miles away from Brown Mountain. And I took them on a small mountain climbing, rock climbing expedition that was pretty hair-raising at times, and I'm sure that they would tell you about that. The bit about the psychic, though, to give the backstory. There's long been this story about there being like an underground base somewhere in the Linville Gorge. Joshua Warren has told that story over the years. There have been people who have said that they've seen military presence there in the gorge over the years, and that's true, actually. Green Berets and other different units have conducted training in the Linville Gorge because it's a very remote wilderness. And that's primarily why there are people who have been there and who have been carrying out these military operations. But as you can imagine, there have been a lot of conspiracy theories and things that have been promoted about that, such as the fact that there were that their military presences actually represented the fact that there was, rather than ongoing operations that occurred there was actually some sort of an installation. But there's absolutely not a shred of proof of that. So anyway, the story goes that years ago, there was a fellow who I'd become acquainted with named Don Cooper, and he is a MUFON investigator. I haven't spoken with him in years. And he had invited me to it was the home of a couple. And they were their property was being besieged by some sort of terror. And he said, you know, I really would appreciate, Mike, if you'd come and talk with these people and meet with me one day. And so my girlfriend Antonia at the time and I traveled together, and we went and met Don and the couple who owned the home. And they had described that the home was repeatedly struck by lightning, and that there was a strange sense of there being a presence nearby. And at one point during the discussion, they also pointed out that one of the two who lived there the woman had said that she had suffered from a rare kind of a hypersensitivity, like an allergic kind of a condition where she was extremely allergic to different kinds of molds and fungus and things, but also that she couldn't be in close proximity to electromagnetic fields, that if she had a lot of devices in a room that she wouldn't sleep well, things like that. Now, the name for that condition, I will point out, is called electrical hypersensitivity and multiple allergy, if memory serves. And especially in the British UFO circles, there's been a lot of research into people who claim to have encounters and contacts and things who have suffered from this condition. And this woman had said that not only was she very disturbed by electromagnetic fields, but that due to the concerns about wood rotting and molding over the years and whatnot, their house had been built on a steel frame and there was very little wood in the structure. It sat on top of a hill. So we have a metal structure on top of a hill that's being repeatedly struck by lightning. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I don't know that we have to attribute this to an ancient evil alien presence, okay? Excuse me for interrupting you, Micah,
but you did write about this in your first book, right? Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule?
Yeah, one of the last chapters, Red. I did. I included this in there.
And, okay, I remember this story. Yeah.
And I actually talked about it in that context as kind of a cautionary tale, because what ends up happening is that Don, wonderful guy that he was, confided to me at that time, and he actually leaned in and said at that point that two psychics had confirmed for him that there was an underground base beneath the level gorge that could be accessed through a opening in the stone between two pillars near the base of Table Rock. Okay, that's where that story came from.
Mm-hmm,
and I'm sure I did tell this to Greg and the guys, by the way. So anyway, what this has to do with Greg Newkirk and all this is that he had been interested, after being contacted by a fella some time ago, in this story about these little alien-like entities that purportedly were running around this property up there in Kentucky and everything. And I think that Greg took the story kind of half-seriously. You know, he was, at the time, of course, still operating the Who Forwarded website, which at times reported seriously on things, but there was a lot of content that was kind of geared more toward, you know, humor and entertainment and enjoyment, which I think is okay. You know, sometimes, as long as it's labeled as such. And Greg certainly feels the same way. So, in fact, that's something he and I definitely have in common, is our sense of humor about all this. So he put up this funny post about the alien cave-based task force. And I told him, I said, if you guys ever really do get tasked to go into a cave in Kentucky, I do like caving, didn't expect to find goblins, but said I'd be more than happy to join you. So when he came down, he was interested in the story about the purported underground base and the idea of there being a cave, and said, you know, if we're going to be in the area, would you like to take us up there around Brown Mountain and show us some caves and stuff? And I said, sure. And so I actually did take him to a location that Don Cooper claimed between these two large stones. You had to crawl down into this ravine. It was rather death-defying, but we all did it together. We crawl down into this ravine, and there are these large stone pillars, and you make your way down to the bottom of the mountain, and then there's a cave right there. And I took him in that cave, but you go in that cave, and there's nothing in there. I mean, the cave doesn't go way back into the mountain or anything. It's just kind of a large opening, kind of a grotto of sorts. And we kind of joked that this was what... And this was all filmed, by the way, for their documentary they were doing at the time. But we kind of joked that this might have been the entrance to the underworld that Don had been told that two psychics told him was the entrance to a cave base. So, again, that was the story from the psychics, and I put about as much credibility behind the idea of the psychics being right in their estimation as, you know, with that Bigfoot is an alien that's been sent down here to claim humans for pets. So
instead of an alien cave base, it was more like an alien weekend getaway.
Yeah,
just a little tiny.
it might have been an alien camping spot. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, if by alien you mean me.
So. Yeah, but in Greg Newkirk's post, there was this idea that there was something like a big rock blocking the entrance to this passageway,
and that it
seemed that the rock was, you know, not so much as some kind of natural cave-in, but something that was deliberately put there to block the entrance.
I will say this. Within that cave, there is kind of a great big large kind of a stone face that kind of protruded out. And we joked, we said, you know, if there was any kind of an entrance here, this would have to be the door, you know.
Okay.
Again, I'm not sure how seriously anyone really took that. Again, to me, it's quite obviously just a little grotto that's formed by the rock formations there. I mean, it's certainly a cave that you can go up into and crawl into, but it's not like a cave system, and there didn't seem to be any overt evidence of something, you know, that you couldn't, you know, that was blocking or obstructing one's ability to go further. Now, there is a little compartment up above that stone that goes a little further back, but I think we were able to shine flashlights up there and, you know, see that it didn't go too much further. So, but yeah, so that's the story about the psychic again was something that was related to me by a MUFON investigator who was convinced during this meeting we'd had years earlier that there was a base and that had been confirmed independently for him by psychics who had a vision about this. And he kind of tied it all together in that region and said that there was something really terrible. He believed that there was a crash that had occurred up there around Spanish Oak Mountain. He believed that there was, again, this underground base. And he further believed that the experiences described by the women at the home where the lightning strikes were occurring was evidence of an ancient evil extraterrestrial presence. And he told us that day, you know, I hate to have to say it, but I came here today to tell you, you must leave. You have to leave because your lives are in danger. And as I was being walked out to the car, Antonia and I, by the gal who suffered she did claim that she felt presences at times, especially in the early mornings when she'd be out on the back porch. And she certainly said that she had, you know, multiple allergies and you know, sensitivity to EM fields. But she said, I don't really know what to make of all this. And I said to her, I said, I want you to just take one thing to heart. It'll be the final thing I say to you. Don't believe everything that you hear. Mm-hmm. So you guys have put a lot of time, a lot of money into this property. You know, I don't think it's right to leave. Be very discerning. Be very careful about what you choose to believe. And I tried to call her back the following Monday when I could speak to her more frankly about things, and she didn't answer the phone or return the call. But I wanted to kind of warn her, this is where I think, frankly, pseudoscientific thinking, i.e. there's an alien cave base, which has been confirmed to me by psychics, that can be very dangerous. And when a person is telling people you need to leave your home because your lives are in danger, I mean, I think that this is, I don't know, I don't know, many would call it delusional thinking. And I thought that was a very sad circumstance because it was a very belief-oriented story that had been orchestrated. There was very little truth to it. The reality of the situation was, I think, that the individual in question suffered from a electrical hypersensitivity and multiple allergy condition that caused the sensations in the environment, and she even said as much. And furthermore, that by virtue of those problems that existed, which resulted in the structure that they lived in being built primarily from metal but sitting exposed on top of a hill, I mean, it was an obvious target for lightning, you know? So, funny how that all ties in, but again, you know, there's so many weird legends that have been worked into the Brown Mountain narrative over the years. So, yeah, there's definitely some truth to that. But again, I hadn't heard what they discussed on Mysterious Universe. I was interested to see how that was presented. No psychic ever told me, and I certainly wouldn't have taken, you know, that to heart as the proof for there being an alien base.
Yeah, and this presents this conundrum or discussion that is ever present in the 4chan field or the alternative field, whether psychedelic substances either they propel you to see things that are in only in your mind, or whether they make you more sensitive to aspects of reality that go unnoticed to most of the population. And maybe, okay, this person was becoming more sensitive to things because of her geographical circumstance. You know, the fact that she happened to live in this place, which seemed to be some kind of natural, you know,
locus point.
Exactly, sort of, yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah, a place where a lot of energy seems to concentrate. So then there's the very hard question of whether that made her to hallucinate all sorts of stuff or made her more sensitive to stuff that was there, that was present, but got unnoticed by people who were less sensitive than her.
Well, I will point this out. Here's one thing I took away from that particular instance. If I remember correctly, she had said that most of the electrical appliances had to be on one side of the house because they disturbed her. You know, they kept her from being able to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so her bedroom was located on the, you know, the far side of the house, the opposite side of the house. And I remember asking, she said she would step out on the porch, and one particular morning she knew that she was alone. There weren't even any animals outside, but she distinctly felt a presence, she said, standing on her porch one morning, early in the morning, by herself. I asked her, I said, where is your porch located in relation to your home? What's the nearest room, you know, that the porch is outside of? And she said, the kitchen where, of course, the oven, where a number of appliances, you know, refrigerators, microwaves, you know, all of these objects are. And I remember thinking that that was significant because, again, she was on the side of the house where more of the electromagnetic interference presumably would have been, and this is where she claimed all by herself that she feels a presence. And I was reminded of the research of Michael Persinger.
Exactly. I was thinking about this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where people have said, you know, again, especially when particular portions of the brain are exposed to electromagnetic, I guess what you would call stimulation, given the circumstances, they have reported in laboratory settings individuals feeling a presence in the room with them, which, again, Persinger and others tried to kind of use to explain such things as ghosts and haunted houses, but this seemed like a dead ringer. I don't know in all instances that that would be an accurate parallel to be made, but in this one, I certainly thought, my gosh, I mean, she's standing on the side of the house where she's most prone to be affected by electrical devices and electromagnetic fields, electrical fields and magnetic fields, I guess I should say. And here she is describing this exact same circumstance that Michael Persinger's reports in laboratory studies had participants describe. So it seemed very clear to me, and yet, in the absence of knowledge of that information, my MUFON friend, of course, had interpreted it a little differently. There's an actual presence there. There's an ancient alien presence. It's malevolent. It's trying to drive them away from the property. Psychics have confirmed this for me. You see, I mean, it's a perfect juxtaposition of, you know, the belief-based attitudes that, you know, rely on verification through equally implausible means. I'm not saying that people couldn't really be psychic or that maybe certain people don't actually have premonitions, but I'm certainly saying that if you want proof of something that seems implausible, you can't prove it through a psychic prediction, you know, or you can't. Do you see what I'm saying? Trying to prove one implausible or one unlikelihood with another equal unlikelihood.
No, absolutely. You know, it's this sort of sort of working backwards from an assumption, I think, really reared its head with the recent missile test off California, which you will have people providing very reasonable explanations or very reasonable evidence that, yes, it was indeed a missile, as anomalous as it may have appeared. But there are still people who are saying, well, no, it was too weird looking. It can't just be a missile. They're working backwards from a point of belief.
Yeah. And there are still people who are questioning. They're saying, come on, really? Missile? You tell me any kind of a missile that looks just like that. And I'm thinking, you know, days before the thing was seen, there was already a report. It'd be one thing if they just all of a sudden start scrambling and saying, okay, this was a missile test and we hadn't been given any kind of forewarning. But, you know, there had been that report, several reports, in fact, talking about how flights out of LAX were going to be diverted over land, which was probably going to wake a lot of people up at night because the military would be conducting tests over the course of the next week. I mean, they had already announced it. So when I saw the video, Kyle Filson, actually, of Expanded Perspectives, was sent the video by one of their listeners. He sent it to me the following morning. I mean, and I immediately thought, okay, off the California coast, pretty obviously a missile test. And sure enough, it had already by that time been confirmed. And then people start questioning it. But I'm thinking, we'd already been given advanced knowledge. So one of two things happens here if there's truly a conspiracy afoot. Somebody in the military knew that something weird was going to show up in the sky, and so they make up a bogus story beforehand to account for it, knowing it's going to occur. Or we have to assume that, well, we knew it was going to occur because it was the missile test that they said it was.
Yeah, exactly. And although to touch on one thing, you know, going back to the Persinger research, I think that it's important as much as it would seem to imply that electromagnetic stimulation of the temporal lobe can generate these sensations, it's important to not say that, therefore, these experiences might not exist.
Right.
I think exactly. I think it's entirely possible that there may be some sort of objective reality to that that is made apparent by the simulation of the temporal lobe.
Yeah, I think I'm remembering that you, in that same chapter, mentioned that short story about Edgar Allan Poe. Can you remind me of the title of that short story?
I think that was a Lovecraft story, actually. It was
Lovecraft, yeah.
It was From Beyond. The reason I tied
From
it in
Beyond.
Yeah, in the chapter, the reason I tie that in is because, you know, proponents of the idea that an endogenous chemical release of, for instance, dimethyltryptamine into the bloodstream could cause certain hallucinatory experiences, such as Dr. Rick Strassman, they've long suspected that the source of the DMT that is released into the body is the pineal gland. Now, of course, research with regard to DMT began, I think, probably clinically in studies that began in maybe the 1950s. But again, in the 1990s is when the speculative connection between DMT and the pineal gland began to be made by Rick Strassman, and others have sought to look at that just as well. Scientists are still, I mean, we're well aware of the fact that DMT is produced in our bodies. Again, a powerful hallucinogen, yet it is synthesized in our bodies. It's a close chemical cousin to serotonin. We don't know exactly what purpose it serves or exactly why it's produced in our bodies or why there may be variances in the amount produced at certain times. These are all mysteries that we're still kind of trying to understand. And it is speculated by some that certain people who enter mystical, altered states of consciousness through meditation may be able to somehow, I guess, upset the chemical balance within the body, such that what Strassman refers to as an endogenous release of DMT might occur. But what's interesting is that H.P. Lovecraft, I think in the 1920s, wrote the story From Beyond, in which the villain, Crawford Tillinghast, this mad scientist, creates a device that utilizes electromagnetic stimulation to resonate the pineal gland, which allows you to see alternate dimensions occurring around you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is incredible because, I mean, this guy, he was touching on themes that would show up in later research, decades later, and yet this was a fictional story. And I'm thinking, where could the inspiration for that have come from, you know?
Indeed.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. I always found interesting the cross sections of the human brain, how it looks like that particular portion of the human brain where the pineal gland is located has a striking resemblance to the Eye of Ra. In Egyptian iconography as well, so it's like it's almost as if I remember I was reading somewhere where somebody was talking about how it might have been actually Fort who was talking about how, you know, the tea kettle whistled the power of steam for centuries until eventually it was just steam engine time. Everybody's like, oh, I guess we can harness this for something. So it's almost like the universe has been whispering, you know, pineal gland, and only recently do we actually glom onto the fact that there might be some validity there.
Yeah, it's interesting how we kind of come back around to that idea from time to time. And I guess the point is that with all the intuitive leanings, I mean, Descartes, you know, referring to it as the seat of the soul and all these kind of things, you know, what is it about the pineal gland that is of such peculiar significance to people? You know, I guess, guys, we're coming up on a break, so when we come back, maybe we'll expand on that a little, because, of course, there are a couple of ways in which one might presumably gain access to the DMT experience. One that we've already touched on, the endogenous release, or maybe an external environmental factor that could cause the same sort of thing to happen. But then, of course, there's also the introduction of the chemical into the system through the recreational use of drugs, which is highly controversial. Maybe we'll touch on that aspect of this when we come back. Catching up with Red Pill Junkie and Joshua Cutchin here on the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be right back. Micah Hanks, this is the Grayling Report. Welcome back. In this hour, I am joined by a couple of marvelous co-hosts, none other than Joshua Cutchin. He's the author of the book A Trojan Feast, and then Red Pill Junkie, blogger extraordinaire, artist, and also news contributor not only to the Daily Grail, blogger for Mysterious Universe, and of course also a contributor regularly to this program, the Grayling Report. Guys, great to have you here with me tonight. In fact, I hope we can do it more often. I've talked to both these guys about getting them on for semi-regular co-hosting positions on this show. Honorary members of the Grayling Gang, as it were, so if you like their presence here on the program, maybe we can do it kind of regularly, get these guys involved. And I certainly appreciate having both of you here. So welcome back.
Thanks so much. If you like us, tell others. If not, tell no one.
That's right.
Yeah, I would love to, you know. I mean, I'd love to get together with you guys and exchange in these kinds of conversations. And I think that's kind of like my purpose in life.
We are. I think a lot of us feel that way. And I'll just say this, too. Being able to talk with guys like the two of you and the many, many of you out there in the listening audience, you know who you are. You know, people like Lindsay Morrison, obviously, Mark Brady, Jonathan Wilson, so many over the years who have, you know, Melissa, gosh, the list goes on and on and on, but you guys know who you are. People who I correspond with on a weekly and sometimes a daily basis trying to put together, I'm not able to respond to everybody. I feel particularly bad that there are so many people who I wish to be able to respond to who I haven't yet, and I'm going to try and catch up on emails while I'm traveling some this week. But that said, this experience of being able to share knowledge with one another kind of enlivens me, because I go through this state of mind where, or I'm actually almost perpetually in this state of mind these days, where I'm kind of in a state of despair over the warring factions of what I call the skeptic atheist community, and then I think the belief oriented, anything that is contrary to science is what we believe. I find that there's a lot of common ground between groups that can say, you know, hey, a UFO may exist, whatever a UFO ultimately actually is, you know, and I think you can also be very skeptical. I say I'm a skeptic on this show, you know. I would consider myself maybe a slightly more skeptical person than, for instance, Red Pill Junkie. you know, but that's what's neat about you and I is that, you know, we are quite different in our approaches. You know, Josh, you probably kind of fall somewhere in the middle between Red and I. But Red, Red, how many times have you and I ever gotten into a knockdown, drag-out fight? I mean, we've pissed each other off a couple of times, but, I mean, there's not anger as a result of differences in opinion on things. You know, there's a constant...
Yeah, exactly. I've never felt that we've gotten in some kind of quarrel. I mean, we each other have our own personal positions with regards to perhaps UFOs and other types of what we call paranormal phenomena. But there is not kind of like animosity over the fact that we may not see eye to eye 100% on the matter. You know, we respect each other's viewpoints. And that's something that I personally, in my own, you know, subjective positions, see that is lacking in the skeptic realm. I think that in the skeptic realm, it's more of that if you don't follow the party line, you're out and you are, you know, ostracized from the group.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, there are great skeptics out there. One that comes to mind, Massimo Pagliucci, a contributor to Skeptic Magazine. He's a philosophy professor. Brilliant guy. But he did this blog post a while back talking about, you know, his disdain with people like P.Z. Myers, who, of course, Red, you know, you and I have met and had some interactions with. I actually assumed I'd probably like P.Z. if I just got him aside and got to talk to him in a public setting, you know, personally, rather than flame wars going back and forth on the internet. Sadly, I can tell you that my experience with P.Z. Myers is that, you know, he was a rude person. He was unfriendly. He was unwilling to have much of a discussion, really. He was actually much more friendly while he was on stage than he was when you're talking with him one-on-one. And I remember the last thing he said to me is he kind of looked at me and he goes, you know, I'd love to get you involved in one of our public debates that we might do on one of the events at some point. And the way he kind of put his hands together and looked at me and said it, it was obvious PZ was saying, let's not get you actually involved in a meaningful dialogue. We want to get you up there and just pick on you and just try and make you look like an idiot. And I'm thinking, guys, you know, I have probably more in common with you and people who are thinkers in the academic circles like you in terms of what I know my own beliefs to be than I do with probably most of the, you know, attendees at UFO conferences. I prefer the latter, on the other hand, because those people, when they disagree with me, don't come up and have to pick a fight. They don't have to try and make themselves feel good or look better, more intelligent, whatever, by virtue of having a public debate with someone that they feel that they are not only supposed to, but should be by virtue of what they do, it's like they feel like they're knighted or that they're deputized to engage in arguments. I don't know, it's a strange thing. I have people who I disagree with resolutely, who I adore because we show each other respect in the dialogue that we have. And so this is why it's such a conundrum for me. And I'll quit running my mouth here. I know you guys want to jump in. It's important to me, though, I think that, you've got to be you've got to be willing to have dialogue, and to have dialogue, respect has to exist. And I have to be able to shut my mouth. So go ahead, Red.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that on the last Paradigm Symposium in 2014, I managed to talk to this gentleman who was interviewed by the people of Open Minds about this supposed story and how he managed to learn about, you know, the secret U.S. government alien management program, you know, by reading some secret files on his aunt's office on some U.S. Air Force base. And I remember how I managed to interact with this person, and I, you know, honestly said to him that I was very skeptical of his story. And I was so struck by his response. You know, he never got angered. He said, "Okay, if you don't believe me, I don't mind. I don't care." You know, and that's something that I feel that is lacking in the skeptic camp. You know, maybe this is my own personal bias, but you know, this person showed to me how he didn't mind my opposition to his story or his. Story that he was promoting. And that is something that when you interact with people in the skeptic camp online, that's something that you don't find. You know, you find opposition, you find vitriol, you find snark, you find cynicism, and that's something that, well, it's not that I want to elevate this person on top of this other, but credit where credit's due, you know. I mean, this person was willing to be, you know, taken at face value. He didn't care if you believed his story or not. So that's something that really affected me as someone who was skeptical of his story.
Yeah, and I'll say one more thing really quickly. I'd mentioned Maximo Pagliucci, the philosopher. If we were wrong in our estimation of the way that some people who appear and present themselves as being representative of skepticism, atheism, and such, if they weren't truly, I think being unnecessarily angry or you know, combative with people who they felt were of different mindset, people like Maximo himself, a skeptic, a contributor to magazines like Skeptic, you know, I don't think that they would have the same criticisms. And when you start seeing people within the skeptic movement, just like, I guess, if you want to call me someone who is interested in UFOs, I don't consider myself part of a UFO movement, but I certainly have criticisms of the way some UFO thinkers approach the subject. I disagree with them strongly, but I'll very, you know, politely articulate my issues with their perspectives on things. And I see Maximo and others doing the same thing. They'll point at someone like PZ and say, you know, are we really doing anything to further our position? Are we doing anything to advance knowledge? And interestingly, by the way, to his credit, I don't disagree with everything that PZ Myers says, and he's even said the same thing. He left the skeptic movement a couple of years ago himself because he had felt that there was far more negativism rather than true skepticism. In other words, people just espousing negative, you know, attitudes about things without offering any kind of resolution or anything positive, anything with hope of moving forward. And PZ himself, so I don't want to sound like I'm just criticizing him, because he himself, and to his great credit, has even said, if we're just going to be negativists so that we can all feel like we're part of a club or a culture, you know, or a movement, you know, we need to also be furthering science. We need to be adding to the dialogue. The skeptic movement today is doing less and less of that, and therefore I want nothing to do with it. So guys like even PZ himself have said that they see this as a problem, the attitudes espoused by many, and they choose to remove themselves from the cult-like club, I suppose, of skeptic atheism. Again, being a skeptic myself, and I maintain that I am, I think it's important to realize sometimes that people's attitudes, that they're operating completely unaware of how they are being perceived by others, and they don't even realize that what they think they're doing, which is right and which is the only way to see the world, is in fact a strange kind of a psychological trend that is just as dogmatic as anything apart from that group which they have made themselves, you know, consistent of. It's very strange to me. It really is.
This is funny. This has been quite on my mind because two of my really good friends, Have been going back and forth on my Facebook wall. One of them is present tonight. but they represent pretty opposite sides of the spectrum. And what I find time and again, you know, being a relative neophyte to this whole situation, I have found more civility, tolerance, and intellectual honesty in Fortiana than I ever have in a lot of the skeptic realms. But even beyond that, the thing that I find in these unexplained areas that you will not find in a lot of these other not more scientific, but in traditional scientific disciplines, is the idea of self-doubt. I think everybody who has an experience like this, at least some point, has that moment of self-doubt. And I think there are a lot of people out there who have seen something anomalous, to their dying day will have some degree of self-doubt about what they saw and are eager to find the actual answer. But on the other hand, on the reverse side of the coin, a lot of people who are in the scientific establishment don't have that self-doubt. It's proven it conforms to my paradigm, therefore it must be the way it is. And they're just not willing to come out and admit that. And I've found some really, really fine, top-notch people in this field, and that's part of it. I mean, it's the same reason that fundamentalism turns people off. No one wants to hear somebody who has all the answers. You know, we want to have some things left unanswered.
Absolutely. You know, this reminds me of something. I know that we wanted to talk about the psychedelic thing when we were coming back out of the last break, but there was another subject that you just reminded me of that I've got in my notes here, Josh. And I'd actually like to bring this up on the heels of what you said. Maybe we can get back around to psychedelics a little later, because I think it all kind of ties in this discussion. But the question was, it was an article that was featured at IO9 the other day, Why Physicists Need Philosophers. And there'd been this debate that was raging in the article. I actually have it here. And this is what it says. Jane Anders, writing for IO9, there's a spat brewing between some theoretical physicists and philosophers of science recently, and NPR's Adam Frank wrote about it at his blog. It started when one philosopher of science, David Albert, questioned the notion that the universe came from nothing, as the title of Lawrence Krauss's new book claims. This quickly escalated into a debate over whether philosophy of science was even a worthwhile endeavor or just a distraction from the hard nuts and bolts work of figuring out the nature of the universe. So Frank, over at the NPR blog, had a great explanation of just why physicists are wrong to dismiss philosophy out of hand. And this is what he wrote. Richard Feynman was famously scornful of the philosophy of science. He thought it was immune to finding relevant results or making real progress. But the problem is that we aren't living in Richard Feynman's age of physics anymore. Something strange happened on the way to the modern intersection of cosmology and foundational physics. Some measure of philosophical sophistication seems helpful, if nothing else, in confronting this new landscape. It's one thing for physicists exploring carbon nanotubes to say they have no use for philosophy. Their work lives or dies by experimental data that can be collected tomorrow. But over the last few decades, cosmology and foundational physics have become dominated by ideas that appear to take a page from science fiction and, more importantly, remain firmly untethered to data. Concepts like hidden dimensions of reality, like string theory, or hidden infinite possible parallel universes, the idea of a multiverse, are radical revisions of the very concept of reality. And since detailed contact with experimental data might be decades away, theorists have relied mainly on mathematical consistency and aesthetics to guide their explorations. In light of these developments, Frank writes, it seems absurd to dismiss philosophy as having nothing to do with their endeavors. And I have to say, there are often times where I see even a mathematical justification for an idea presented by physicists, and I kind of go, but why? How do you know? I mean, you know, for instance, okay, Big Bang, great. I remember Stephen Hawking at one point saying, and others have actually said this too, no point in worrying about what came before the Big Bang. That is kind of outside the sphere of importance to us. As scientists, we can only deal with what is really, truly important to us. And frankly, to the physicist of today, what happened before the Big Bang is a nil question. It doesn't matter. Let's worry about what caused the Big Bang, and let's worry about whatever happened afterward. The philosopher will always be the one, and this is the difference, who says, well, no, what did happen before? Does a idea such as before or after even apply if we think that far outside? And sometimes we do see that there are philosophical ideas that might stretch, if not fall beyond, the boundaries set by modern physics. And yeah, I do think we need philosophy. We do need philosophy, and this has been an ongoing debate. So, Josh, what you said kind of reminded me of this ongoing debate between, which has been something that's decades. Actually, it's not just been decades, it's been centuries. And we're still dealing with it just today. I was reading an essay the other night by Bertrand Russell, and he was talking about the way that we can look at the laws of conservation of energy, and he was applying all of this through the the philosophical mindset. You know, how do we know what we know about the world, and how can we, in keeping with the laws of science, kind of bridge the paradigm, so to speak? It's incredible to me that just as equally, or rather in equal measure to what we see with, you know, the skeptics and the believers or whatever, you also see scientists and philosophers are kind of warring with one another because of ideological differences. I mean, so it's not exclusive to the skeptics and the believers. We see that there are a lot of different areas where we find that disciplines conflict with one another based on attitudes and ideas.
No, I totally agree. And to me, you know, I was trained as a classical musician, and I sort of tend to think of this argument as being, you know, well, we have all these music theoreticians who can tell us about, you know, the underlying harmony and chord structure, and they can tell us about, you know, the Erlini of this particular line or whatever. So we don't need performers, but you can tell me as much as you want to, all of the theoretical trappings of the Goldberg variations, we still need Glenn Gould to play the darn thing and to make some sense of it and to make it fit into, like, why is it important otherwise?
What a good analogy, by the way.
Thanks. Appreciate it. I mean, but it's in some ways, and look, I have a lot of friends who are music theory majors and who are teaching music theory around the country. So it's not like I'm bagging on theorists. You know, the theorist needs the performer needs the theorist, the warrior needs the pacifist, and the pacifist needs the warrior. You know, they're a part of a symbiosis, and to think that one can go without the other is incredibly foolhardy.
I certainly think so. You know, RPJ, this brings me back around to something that you and I have talked about a lot. I'm interested in how the idea of consciousness fits into this. And let me make a point that kind of illustrates the connection between the previous argument and where we're about to go here in a moment. We look at science as being something that, and this is what the philosopher would say, science is of course, you know, the empirical data that we gather about, you know, through observation, through rigorous testing, through repeatability. You know, there are a rigid criteria. There should be, there must be, for science to work as a process. And again, I think a lot of the time people say, see, this is what science does. Well, you know, again, science isn't an entity almighty unto itself. You know, it's not some omnipotent thing. Science is a process that we use to try and discern factual data, you know, with which we can never be 100% about, but which we can observe with enough consistency and with enough repeatability that we have the concept of what we might call a law. And to me, it's interesting because no matter what, at the end of the day, it all comes down to what is observable. And to observe, it must be filtered through what? The human senses. And I have often wondered what it would be like to observe physical laws of the universe through the lens of knowledge that an alien being might provide, whether or not biological in nature, you know. So rather than to say an alien, which seems to denote something that is physical but different from us, maybe we would say, you know, some form of consciousness not quite human, which brings us down to the fundamental question. When it comes to philosophy, this is what the philosophers ask. Really, in terms of the nature of consciousness, in terms of the nature of human observability, we can't get beyond the boundary of observing from human perspective. Everything that we look at, therefore, despite the certainties afforded us through rigorous scientific testing, is anthropomorphized and inexplicably will be, or rather not inexplicably, but I think inescapably will be, although it's certainly at times inexplicable, I think.
Here's my humble take on it.
Yeah, please.
Science is a very, very powerful tool, if perhaps the most powerful tool that our species has ever encountered. The most powerful tool to find answers. But philosophy is the thing that helps you elaborate better questions. So in order to think that science can get rid of philosophy is, I think, missing the point entirely. I think that, like we said in our private conversation earlier, philosophy keeps science in check. You know, philosophy keeps science honest.
It certainly does. When it comes to the discussion of consciousness, though, you know, one question I want to put it to both of you guys, but I'm kind of directing it at you, RPJ.
Yeah.
Because you've cited this many times in the past, you know, Graham Hancock talking about the war on consciousness. Mm-hmm. So to make the philosophical tie-in, if really philosophy is, in essence, kind of understanding the interrelationship between human, what it means to be human, what human observation is, and how perhaps that colors our interpretation of observable phenomena in the universe. Is the war against philosophy that we see in science essentially what Hancock might term a war on consciousness?
That's a great question. You know, I until now I've never thought about it, but yeah, perhaps the same dismissal and scorn coming from the material science with regards to philosophy is somehow linked to what Graham Hancock feels there is with regards to the, you know, what he perceives as a censorship and almost as a deliberate war on these psychedelic substances that he thinks could help humankind expand our consciousness beyond our current limitations. And that's something that is worth considering, you know, for perhaps I feel that in the end there is not a deliberate war on consciousness. I think that is all of this is part of the machinery of the status quo, you know, some kind of like momentum, a societal momentum that is, you know, trying to drive our society into a certain path and trying to dismiss the things that would impede that momentum, that path in our society. So obviously psychedelic substances is something that our current society sees as a burden, something that should be censored, eliminated, you know, criminalized. And that sentiment, that philosophy, that perspective is also the things that shuns away things as philosophers questioning the things in science. And even, you know, how science addresses the things that we fortunes are interested in, you know, the things that seems to escape away from the realm of science, or not escape away the realm of science, but challenge the model that science has tried to build.
Yeah.
You know, the UFO phenomenon, altered states of consciousness, precognition, remote viewing, telepathy, near-death experiences. So somehow all of these things are connected in a way that we humbly are trying to criticize and maybe hopefully try to undermine.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, it's almost as if we've reached the point with consciousness studies that if we had decided to, if it's almost as if we're explorers having surveyed our entire continent, and we're afraid to travel across the sea to see where there be dragons. You know, we've decided that we're not going to go there. And, you know, people come back from going there and they tell us all these fanciful stories, and we've decided, well, no, that's the edge of the known world. We can't go there. We're not going to sail our ships off the edge. And I think it's really a tragedy that people aren't really trying to push more in that direction. And I don't think that necessarily, as Red said, I don't think it's necessarily a deliberate war on philosophy or a war on consciousness. I just think it's basically just an outgrowth of that.
Yeah, you know, I think, and by the way, did I not say it would come back around to psychedelics? See, it all comes full circle, as I promised it would. That's what, something we're renowned for here on the Graylian Report, is getting a little off on a tangent and coming back around, but really this was an intentional tangent tonight. The psychedelic thing is interesting because I would ask this, gentlemen, what can we learn? I think we can learn certain things from psychedelic experiences. But when we're thrusting the brain into an induced altered state, can we really take those experiences which occurred during that altered state as being experiential, you know, within the same context that we might, for instance, look at something we observe in the everyday? I mean, as fallible as the human senses are when not encumbered by psychedelics, how are we to take an experience which is chemically induced and intentionally so as being something that we can gather information, new information from, in a scientific way? Can In other words, the study of psychedelics and hallucinatory experiences indicate anything more than what we might glean on a personal, individual level? Is there really something that science might benefit in terms of the experiencers and their descriptions and retellings of what they experience with the psychedelic experience? Anybody, don't jump in all at once, then.
Okay, well, my own humble opinion is that, if anything, the psychedelic substances could help us observe reality from a different vantage viewpoint, you know, and that's always a good thing, you know, to try to maybe observe a different problem, observe a different circumstances from a different perspective. You know, maybe it will help you find a solution to something that has escaped you under quote-unquote normal circumstances. You know, I mean, we talk about how, you know, this famous quote of Albert Einstein, how, you know, you cannot, I'm paraphrasing here, you cannot solve a problem under the same viewpoint or the same perspective that managed to create the problem. So,
hey, that is so similar, by the way. This may even be the source of that. I don't mean to interrupt, so don't lose your place.
Yeah, go.
But I have the Einstein quote in front of me here. I tweeted it last night. The significant problems we have can't be solved at the same level of thinking that we use to create them.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe, yeah, that's the thing, you know. I mean, like, our politicians and our state leaders are trying to solve problems that, you know, are created by circumstances, you know, that are escaped them. And maybe they are bound to try to solve them under the same perspective. And maybe if, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, that, you know, the next president of the United States should be taken to the Amazons and taking the ayahuasca tea, you know, in order to before taking the, you know, the State of the Union and being sworn into office. And although that will be kind of interesting, you know, thinking about that. But I think that from my perspective, and I'm not a psychedelic user. I've only tried those substances once in my life last year. It didn't seem to have a meaningful effect on him, although I still consider it to have been a positive experience. But I think it's still a valuable and valid avenue. And I think that people like Graham Hancock, who I think we all admire, are advocating for the right for every adult individual to try to decide whether they want to try that path or not. I mean, obviously, in life, there are multiple paths, but I think who gives the right to close some paths and to say those paths are to be avoided over others, you know? I think this is the question that is put over us in this generation right now, when we are having this discussion over whether to legalize some substances that being, you know, satanized, you know, ostracized and considered to be, you know, not only illegal but you know, to be like almost like demonic.
Yeah.
Whether to try to see what benefit we can come up of it.
Josh, we've got about 2 minutes. Any closing thoughts you'd like to add right there?
Well, geez, I think Red did such a good job of summing up a lot of my thoughts. You know, to wax McKinnon, sometimes I wonder if psychedelics aren't deliberately trying to push us towards a realization of the validity of the personal experience. And this has sort of been a road that I've been walking in terms of figuring out all these unexplained things, I think are really emphasizing the importance of the personal experience. And by doing that, if everyone had their own bizarre personal experience and everyone was equally disbelieved by those around them, in some way it might generate empathy for those people in their individual situations that they do have. You know, we live in such a culture where victims are shamed and you know, collectivism is rewarded to such a degree. Sometimes I wonder if it isn't as McKenna would say, Terrence McKenna would say, maybe perhaps the plants are trying to encourage us to, you know, be ourselves. You know, really, really trying to encourage us to realize that each one of us has our own personal experience, and that is the point of everything that we do. That is the journey, and to try to respect the journeys of others.
Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for joining me on the program tonight. It's truly been a pleasure, and we'll be certain to have both of you back. And that's going to be the final word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Thank all of you out there who tune in each week to hear what we discuss on this program. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, I remain here in the Hollow Earth, and we will catch you guys again next time. As always, stay strange out there.
Or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.